Here with Interval, profiles of jazz musicians focusing on their out-of-print jazz recordings. I think I've mentioned before in Fresh Air that when I was a kid, I used to listen to rock and roll radio all the time. And I remember my parents and other adults telling me that when I grew up, I'd outgrow rock and roll. The implication was that when you hit the age of 21, you'd be switching to the stations that play Vic Damone and Mantovani. Well, they were wrong. Most of the people who grew up on rock and roll didn't move on to easy listening. Rock audiences have grown because they have regular listeners now in their 20s and their 30s, as well as in their teens. You can even tell by the commercials. You're more likely to hear a commercial for a new car than you are for pimple cream. The traffic reports given during morning drive time indicate that a lot of the rock listeners are on their way to work. Long-time radio listeners have heard their stations go through considerable changes. With the advent of FM, you could tune away from the screaming DJs to the hip, laid-back, rapping DJ. The personal underground presentation has in many stations been replaced by stricter formats, and in some places by computerized formats. When you listen to the radio, you always wonder what goes on behind the scenes and what the people who you listen to are really like. To satisfy that curiosity and to talk about the state of rock radio, we're joined now by three DJs from Philadelphia's top three rock stations. With me is Michael Picozzi, the morning man on WMMR, David Dye from WIOQ, who's on from 6 until 10, and Gary Bridges, who's on WYSP, also from 6 until 10. Welcome, all of you, to Fresh Air.
Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Michael, you're on in the morning drive time, which is for radio stations considered to be the peak listening time. Your shift starts, what, at 6 in the morning?
6 in the morning.
What happens when you get to work? What do you do once you get there, and what's it like from your end?
Coffee. I live real close to the station and kind of stumble across the street, and I think I should be a couple of minutes ahead in awake next to everybody else. I should be awake before they are because I have to wake them up, I guess.
What kind of feel do you want to give to your listeners when they're waking up to the radio?
Well, it's kind of just wanting to wake them up, let them listen to something I'm playing, let them hear what I'm saying in kind of a, oh, I better turn this up because he may say something I need to know.
Okay. I should say you're also really like sarcastic and funny and ironic on the air. It's very much of a personality type of show. David, now you're on in the evening from 6 right. until 10. Now, is there a certain understanding of like how the evening is supposed to be different from the morning on a station?
I really feel there is in that I feel while Michael's trying to wake people up and get them a little bit more, you know, into their day, I'm definitely trying to cool everybody out. I don't talk as much as Michael does. And I don't, I play longer stretches of music and much probably softer music, too. Of course, the station I work for is aimed towards softer music, too.
Uh-huh. Gary, you're also on from 6 until 10 on WYSP. Is there a difference, do you think, between the way the different stations in Philadelphia sound in the evening?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I kind of represent the other end of the spectrum from what David does.
Right.
I have a little younger audience and play a lot more raucous kind of rock and roll. And maybe I'm a little more irreverent than, you know, than David's approach to the radio. But
do you choose the music that you play, Gary, or is that chosen for you?
The selections I can make are kind of chosen for me. I choose from within a limited format of records that are determined to be right for the audience I'm trying to get.
Can you describe what that format is?
I could describe it in rough terms. There are a number of records, both current and old, that the programmers of the station feel appeal to the audience I'm trying to get. You know, there are maybe 600-800 albums from which I can choose songs. You know, it's kind of left to me to feel out the audience and which tunes from those albums I play. But certain artists that they feel appeal to the audience I need, so that's the choices I'm given.
How much flexibility do you have at WMMR to choose the music that you're going to be playing during your show, Michael?
I have a lot, really. It's in the morning. You don't want we don't play a lot of real new music. In other words, we don't play music that I tell people, hey, you've got to sit back, put your headphones on, and listen to this, because in the morning, there's no time to do that. But within the categories are the same all over, new albums, old albums. But within those categories, basically, I have free rein to run around and do what I want. I try to get music that is not too long, because people are doing lots of things in the morning, and also not too loud guitar-wise, and you know, not anything screeching, but still kind of bright. I don't want to get too intense in the morning.
David, at IOQ, is there a format laid out for you, or do you choose what you play?
I'm directed to certain categories of music, yeah. Like a new record, which would be a hit, or something that would be just starting out. And I actually enjoy having the categories chosen for me in a way, but I within those categories, I have had a pretty broad choice of things. Personal taste comes in, but also a lot more than personal taste, I, just as Gary was saying, I'm going to feel out what the audience is interested in, and a lot of that comes through requests and, I guess, experience and just sort of a feel for it.
When new records come out, who decides what's going to get played and what's going to get thrown out or given away?
Boy, it's really... That's changed a lot. Mostly now it's decided by a music director or a program director. When I used to work in radio a long time ago, there'd be big meetings where all the disc jockeys would sit down, and I like this one, and we'd have battles and political ties would be formed between you know, disc jockeys that wanted a certain record. I'll vote for that if you vote for this. I think that the business people in radio have discovered over the years that that isn't necessarily the best way to get the best music on. Well, what is the best music? I'm saying the music that would appeal to the largest mass of people. But program directors seems to be, I don't know how it is where you all work, but that's how it is where I work.
Program directors?
Yeah, that's it essentially. The largest mass of people is like the most important thing to probably where all three of our stations are going, because that's really the determinant of best as far as the stations are concerned. You know, it's no different from department stores or anything else. Everybody's out to maximize profits, so everyone plays it safer and safer.
A good point to be made about radio is that our product is not our music. Our product is our audience. And we're trying to get, in strict terms, we're trying to get a large audience within a certain framework so we can sell that to advertisers. So that is basically what we're trying to attract with the music, which is sometimes unfortunate for the state of music, but maybe not. I mean,
Well, you want to play the records that the most people are going to want to listen to and enjoy, but how can you measure who's enjoying which record? Which record is really going to make it in your city and which record isn't? Do you judge by how many people call you up?
Sometimes that's a little misleading because you could play a brand new record. You could tell when it's a local band because all the friends call.
Right.
So, you know, this got more this got more reaction than Led Zeppelin. Something's wrong. It's kind of tossed around. We have, in our situation at WMMR, a lot of decisions are made as to, well, this looks pretty good, but we kind of informally run in and give our opinions of it. But it's done by record sales, phone calls, also some research in, you know, when you see people, meet people. Hey, did you hear this? What about this? What about this? And there's a lot of people in the building, and we run around asking them everything. It's real hard to tell because a lot of things are it's kind of a cycle. If no one's playing this brand new record, no radio station is playing it, then how do they know if people like it? Because they're not going to buy it because they can't afford it. So it's kind of this never-ending cycle.
On real big hits, though, don't you always feel that there's a gut reaction that everybody knows?
Yeah, well, that's probably the biggest part of it that I didn't leave in as far as research goes is kind of, do you like it? And I look and say, yeah, I think it sounds pretty good, and we'll put it on the radio and then see what happens.
It's a funny thing with a lot of rock music. I think that it changes with familiarity. Like there's some records or some tunes, I know with me anyways, that I might not even notice the first time it's on, but after hearing it three times, I start to really like it. And other things that might sound really terrific the first hearing, and by the second time, you've really heard enough and you're tired of it. So how do you account for that factor when you're trying to figure out what's going to work?
That's, you've hit on the key. That's one of the things that makes it so elusive. You never really can tell. You know, the way it makes you feel the first time you hear it has often nothing to do with the way the audience will react to it.
I know there's a new approach that's been happening at some FM stations with an almost computerized format in which somebody who has masterminded a format brings it to a station, explains how it can work, and then the station basically buys into that format. Have any of you worked either now or any time at a format like that?
Sure. I have.
Oh, yeah. I have. It's, I found that it works to an extent. There are certain things that always work. You know, hey, play the new Led Zeppelin album a lot. That's kind of, you know, that's kind of basic. But what happens is if the radio station doesn't take this skeleton of a format that says play Led Zeppelin and the Stones and Who a lot and figures out how it fits in their area, then it doesn't work. For example, I worked in Hartford, and in Hartford, Yes isn't very popular. They're okay. People don't get excited about it. And I found when I came to Philadelphia that Yes was amazing. It was so large. And Yes is one of those groups that the, say, the person with the format can go around and say, look, play a lot of Yes because they're real hot. Well, I found that in Hartford they weren't hot, and here they're very, very hot.
That's interesting. I wonder how much regional music there is. I remember somehow when I was growing up, there might be a big hit in Detroit that would never make it in New York or vice versa. And depending on which city you were in, there might be a couple of tunes on the top 10 that you wouldn't know about in another city. And sometimes it doesn't seem like it is that way to that extent anymore, and that things are more of like national hits or national failures. What you were saying, Michael, seems to contradict that a little bit. What's your experience been, Gary?
Well, there aren't regional hits to some degree, and regional groups. Bruce Springsteen's enormous popularity in this area is typical. In the Midwest, people don't care. But people haven't grown up with the same influences that Bruce and the audience around here have. You know, that sort of, romantic sort of thing that Bruce is into just doesn't go over the Midwest. They'd rather hear some, you know, hard rock and guitars or something like that.
Well, everyone thinks that you can go to any city and that the DJs on the city will sound exactly like they do in your city. And you can listen to foreign radio. You can listen to radio spoken in foreign languages in different countries. And you hear that DJ sound to it. But again, there's probably regional differences within the sound that people have on FM stations.
It's funny, because you were just talking about regional music. I feel there's regional radio, and this is something I've sort of wanted to talk to you about these people. Philadelphia has a certain... Philadelphia, to me, doesn't have quite a distinct style of radio. Michael's from New England, and to me, I've always spent a lot of time shuttling back and forth between here and New England, and New England radio is a lot snappier than radio in Philadelphia. Seems to be a lot wittier and a lot more oriented towards new music. And maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. And then the Midwest seems to be a lot more... real hard-driving rock and roll radio. Now, I don't know if these people have any... Is this my impression, or is this some...
No, I found that... Hartford is... I can speak best about that. I've worked there. I've worked a lot of places in New England. Yeah. Hartford is right in between Boston and New York, right in the middle. It can't decide which one it has. But there's battles between Yankee fans and Red Sox fans. And it is. It picks up a little bit of the New York jive, and it picks up a little bit from Boston, which is a faster... tempoed city than Philadelphia is. So it gets stuck in the middle, and music I found was a little bit livelier there. For some reason, Southern rock music, Charlie Daniels Band, and that is very big in Hartford, which actually we could lay a little bit of heaviness on all of us here. Possibly the regionalism is due to radio itself.
Yeah.
Back, you know, in the 60s, your favorite station might have had a couple of people on the air that liked Southern rock, and they played a lot of it, so you grew up with it. Therefore, everybody in that area likes Southern rock. So maybe
it's
our
fault. In this town with Bruce Springsteen, at one point WMMR was the only rock station in this town, and everybody listened to it. And there are certain groups, Genesis, Yes, Bruce Springsteen, who were personal favorites of the people on the air, and they are huge in this city, probably huger in the city than anywhere else. And that's one of the reasons why. It's quite true.
Gary, how did you compare Detroit and Philly?
Well,
I don't want to get you off the track.
It's true, but it's not completely true either. There are some things that radio can shape, but there are other things that, well, typical example. At WYSP, about a year ago, we started playing some groups that had gotten pretty much ignored in the market, that had been big hits in a lot of other places. Mm-hmm. And as a kind of a, I don't know what, it, you know, there's an awakening of a cult of people who were into those groups and got into those groups. AC/DC is a typical example of that. It's a sort of a kiddie-leaning, real hard rocking band that hadn't gotten much exposure in the market at all and had almost sold out the Spectrum a few weeks ago as a result of a year's airplay on their stuff. So I think there are regional differences, but, you know, not completely controllable by radio.
No, also radio can never foist a lousy song on the public.
Oh, I was just going to ask you that.
Can't do it because they won't. It would try, but a record companies, I'm sure, would have radio stations try. But you can't do it no matter how much you take a record because everybody has seen it's some strange song that some radio station is playing for whatever reason. And no matter how much it's played... you know, sort of ruining that recycle
rather than some people like.
Yet I'm sure there's some things that have really surprised you in terms of how they've become hits, songs that you thought really would not and
things pass you by. Sometimes you don't pick up on something.
What are some of the things that have surprised you in terms of
popularity? Well, I was really working in the backwaters of radio for a couple of years. I was working in Maine, and we were really, it was about talking about regional radio, we were really off. It was like having a piece of the Midwest transferred to the Northeast, and they were very into Southern rock and into Bob Seger and kind of Midwestern music. But something that would have been perfect for us, but we ignored, was Heart when they broke. And we were like the last station in the country to get on Heart. And it would have been perfect for us, but we sort of had our, you know, ostrich kind of thing about that group. So that's sort of an example of that.
Is there anything that surprised you, Michael, in terms of becoming really popular when you thought it was basically a dog?
Specifics? No. On the spot, I can't think of anything.
Can you think of any, Gary?
No. The occasional sort of reactionary record, those always surprise me. You know, there's a great history of Sergeant Barry Sadler, you know.
Okay.
You know, things like that always surprise me, but then I just, going, there they are. And, you know, those maybe some of the biggest hits of all time. You know.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the changes that FM rock radio has gone through. Now, in the earlier part of the 70s, rock radio was a very stream of consciousness, personal kind of thing, where for better or for worse, the disc jockey could talk for maybe 10 or 12 minutes, read poetry, good or bad poetry, choose their records, rap about the records afterwards. It was a very personalized type of thing. Were any of you working in radio at that time?
I was. I sort of came in on the tail end of that in Philadelphia. I came after I'd been able to see the excesses of it, and I came when it was just a little bit more controlled. And I enjoyed it, but the more I did it, the more I saw the problems with it, because it really had to rely completely on the disc jockey to have a feel for his audience that had to be right. And more often than not, that's a pretty big task to ask any one person to do, to be completely attuned to what his audience is doing. And I enjoyed doing it. I loved it a lot. And I think some of my best work in radio was done then. But I don't find it terribly appropriate now. Just basically, one of the reasons it's not appropriate now is because people don't listen to the radio in the same way. They don't go home and put their headphones on and sit there for 2 or 3 hours listening to the radio. They're doing other things.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's more a lifestyle change, I think.
I wonder what accounts for that. What do you think some of the advantages and disadvantages of that form of radio in the early 70s?
Well, advantages was it was sometimes really intellectually stimulating. It was all a lot of fun sometimes. It was a lot of fun to do. I mean, to have 3 turntables going at once and 2 cart machines putting things on top of it and doing all your production right on the air using a lot of different sources was fun, but it just, you had to keep a lot of energy going to sustain it. I mean, it's probably, I would think, compared to what I do and compared to, let's say, Michael does in the morning, it's probably more akin to what Michael does with getting bits together and, you know, thinking on top of things like that. I don't know.
Well, it was kind of born out of Top 40 radio was just about the same, and they were playing all the same songs. And a few people, would go home and buy a Doors album and say, this is really good. And then a few people decided that they, maybe working in Top 40 radio, realized that the songs they were playing for their friends weren't the same songs they were playing on the radio. And it kind of was born out of a desire to be different. The first FM stations, FM meaning album rock stations, their only rule was don't sound like the Top 40 stations. Don't play anything they play. Right. And that's how this soft delivery was, because the Top 40 people were, hey, and they're yelling and screaming, you know, 57 minutes of music, here's $10, first person to call me. So they just did the entire opposite and just went, hey, and got real mellow and laid back. But I think what happened musically as the 70s went on, they lost the feel. This is real general. Obviously, there are stations and people that are exceptions to the rule. But all they did all day is that this is great. We just listen to albums all day, and this is our job. This is wonderful. And the audience was still doing, you know, they were going to school and doing their jobs, and they didn't have time to listen to albums all day. So the radio programmers and the radio FM disc jockeys got so far ahead of the average person musically that they had to they were too far gone. And then when people would call up and say, will you please play Grand Funk Railroad? The people would go, oh man, these people are really out of it, man. And they kind of lost touch with the audience.
Yeah, that's really Good point.
It seems that a reaction to that really laid-back personal style, losing touch with the audience, was to almost dictate that the disc jockeys wouldn't be allowed to show personality on the air. Because I remember a period maybe in the mid-70s where a lot of stations were trying to blot out personalities. You were supposed to say a few words, give your ID, introduce the record, give the time, maybe the weather, and that was basically all you were allowed to say.
You can't offend anyone that way.
Was that a reaction, do you think, the swing of the pendulum in the opposite direction to the to progressive underground radio bottoming out?
It was probably searching for the right answer, because it wasn't so much personality, because I think that those early FM disc jockeys didn't think the top 40 stations had any personality. I mean, yelling wasn't a personality to them. In reality, what they were doing was doing the same thing. They were putting on an act. The top 40 disc jockeys were putting on an act, and the early Too Hip for Words people were putting on an act in the other direction. And what happened was they said, well, wait, this is wrong, and this is wrong. Maybe we better not say anything. Let's regroup for a while. And without knowing it, kind of eliminated everything. And it was just talk and play the exact music.
Mikey, you've worked in top 40 radio, right?
Oh, yeah, my very first job.
How did you had to learn how to do the voice, right?
And third job. No, I never really did the voice. I thought that I would have to do the voice, but it never came out. I have early tapes of me from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Fitchburg, Massachusetts. They're really embarrassing.
I should have asked you to bring that. How did I know?
They're too embarrassing. It was basically the same. I listen to them now, and I hear actually saying the same things. And I got into a lot of trouble as a top 40 disc jockey because I just couldn't say, hey, everybody. But I did put on the voice a little bit, pushed it, because all you had to, I mean, if you wanted, obviously wanted to be a success. And the people at the station that were successful when you were working all nights were the ones you tried to sound like, as bad as they might have been. So you tried to sound like them. At the time, I didn't think it was bad. I thought, well, I've got to do that. I said, I'm no good. I just can't talk like this. When actually, I think I had the right idea back then, but it didn't do me any good. I didn't really get any good jobs back then.
Gary, you worked in top 40 radio. Did you have to do the voice?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was just a matter of emulating something. Radio had always been larger than life, you know, from the time it was a forefront entertainment media. You know, it was always something big and magical. And, you know, so you know, as a kid wanting to get into radio, you know, you conjure, you know, maybe drive. I used to drive around in my car at night and try and pump up that voice and rah, you know, it seems ridiculous now, but you emulate some guy with a huge voice on the radio, and so that's what you try to sound like.
How did you really learn how to do that on the air? Did you practice at home? Because it's not like getting on with your regular voice when you're doing that kind of thing.
Well, it isn't, but then I didn't really realize that either at the time. You know, I was real enamored with the business. See, David and I come at this from opposite directions. David got in because of his love of music and all of that, and I really, you know, it was showbiz to me. I used to hang around CKLW and look in the glass and just wish I could be the guy sitting in.
I had a good deal of that too, I have to admit.
But what kind of radio did you listen to when you were growing up, David?
Oh boy, I listened to a real wide spectrum of things. I guess the two opposite extremes of what I used to listen to was Gene Shay's Folk Show, which I think was on the now defunct WHAT in Philadelphia at that point, and Jackson Armstrong, the All-American Boy on WKBW out of Buffalo, was used to be one of my favorite disc jockeys. He's wonderful.
He's great.
Was it very important for you?
Oh, it was real important. I used to sneak into radio stations and watch people and try to. I at some point wanted to be a sportscaster, which is really funny because I don't have much interest in sports now. But I used to, you know, watch games on television and turn off the sound and try to do a play-by-play and stuff. But it's mostly, I think, you were talking about turning on the voice. One thing you find out that when you get on radio and you turn on a record and you're talking over that intro, if the intro is exciting and you pump up the voice anyway. I mean, it just sort of happens. I find more now that I get more interested in the voice as I get older rather than I was earlier.
Michael, did you listen to the radio much when you were young?
Yeah, musically, it was strange. I started listening to the radio real young. It's only a child, you know, parents in the other room watching TV, so I just turned the radio up real loud. And musically, a lot of the songs bothered me. I didn't like them. I didn't like Tommy James and the Shondells too much. I used to like them a little bit. But then at that same time when the Doors had Light My Fire on the radio, or when one of the stations the top 40 stations would play the long version of Inagata Devita. I'd go, that, they're hip. Right. And I would switch back and forth. I think luckily for me, I listened to a couple of people on top 40 radio that didn't sound like top 40 radio in Hartford. Lee Baby Sims, which nobody I'm sure ever know, he drugged out and died probably. But he got on the radio and he said things that other disc jockeys didn't say. One guy would go off and say, hey, Lee Baby Sims is next day, stay tuned for him. And I would turn on my radio and listen, and he'd get on and he'd just call people names. And I said, this guy is all right. And then I started realizing that you didn't have to sound like that. But at that time, I had no interest to be in radio. I think the main thing, probably at the same time with everybody in the room, was, hey, those guys are cool. They must have such a great life. And that image sort of sticks as being show busy and a great life, and I'd like to do it someday. And eventually, it came back and said, yeah, I think I'll do it. And then we found out the truth.
We'll get into that truth in just a moment. But I just want to reintroduce all of you for our listeners who are just joining us. We're talking about rock radio, and with me are disc jockeys from the three top rock stations in Philadelphia. Just speaking was Michael Picozzi of WMMR, who's on in the morning shift, 6 to 10, is it?
Yeah.
Also with us is David Dye, who does the 6 to 10 in the evening shift at WIOQ, and Gary Bridges, who's on 6 to 10 in the evening at WYSP. Can you compare for me what your listeners think your life is like and what it's really like? And you can talk about that in any way you want to, just about what it's like in the studio, what the listeners seem to think it is and what's really happening there, or outside of that if you prefer.
I get a combination of things. First off, everybody is still struck with this feeling that radio announcers are old. You know, like some people are kind of taken aback that I don't wear gray suits, and that, you know, and that it isn't just a big act that I'm putting on. Now, there's a younger sort of crowd that I think, oh, I don't know.
Well, the fact that you're 15, I mean, we should
really. It's the voice. I don't know, but people always, you know, people imagine these great Radio City Colossus things about, you know, oh, there must be 25 people running around there, and engineers and tapes going around, you know. And when I sit there alone at night, just, you know, wishing a pizza guy would stop by or something, then, you know, it's really quite a different thing. I think most people don't know what to think, really, outside of having some very vague ideas.
What kind of life do you think your listeners think of you having when you're doing your show, dude?
Well, I think pretty much like Gary, they think that there's people bringing in cups of coffee and there's five engineers and someone selecting the records and the computer's going in the corner. And you're sitting there picking your toes, you know, and trying to figure out what to play next and spilling the coffee on the, you know. And it's really, at least for Gary and I, we're the only people at the station. Michael's got a newsman and some other people there.
Yeah,
but
one other person.
It's a
destroying the image.
Right, right.
No, so, actually, I do have people getting me coffee and people get my records.
David, maybe we can work at the station someday.
You got to get a deal like that. But it's pretty, at the same time, I worked at a station in Maine where we were on a double trailer on top of a hill about 20 miles from town, and used to go out between songs and pick wild strawberries out in the field and come back in and introduce the next record. I mean, but they thought it was all pretty fancy too. I mean, listeners really do think that it's a pretty fancy situation, when it's more often than not, it's not. It's just a couple turntables and you and a microphone and some commercials.
That's all you need, really.
Yeah.
I know frequently when I meet someone who knows me through the program that they'll say to me, gee, you know, I really didn't think you'd look like that. And of course, you never know if you should be insulted or what. You never know if someone's saying, God, you know, you really are, like, funny looking, and I thought you'd be really attractive or whatever. You have no idea what they mean, and sometimes you ask and sometimes you don't. But it's that, it's always, for me anyways, a kind of awkward thing when someone who knows you and has an image of what you're going to look like gets to really see you in person and compare the real you with who they thought you are. What's that experience been like for you?
It's funny when people don't see it as the fact that you're just another guy who's got a job, and this happens to be what it is. I kind of find that reaction a little bit funny when people find out you're on the radio and they sort of, oh, and they start treating you differently. And that really irritates me to a certain extent. I mean, the ego likes it at some point, I suppose, but it's a little bit funny. I don't particularly like that. I'd rather have people say, I'm the guy who plays the music on the radio and that's my job. But obviously, you know, we're just guys.
Do you find that you usually don't look quite how Someone expected you were going to look?
Yeah, yeah, oh, absolutely.
What do people usually think you're going to look like?
It has to vary standards? With each. I don't really know what it would be standard-wise, but people say, oh, it's generally, oh, you don't look like what I expected.
It's kind of, I think it's kind of a non-image. People, like a dream, because you don't really ever see the faces, so they just assume you look a certain way, but you can never look the same way. Because they never really have a clear picture. I've always wondered if Robert Redford would get on the radio and talk for a while, would people say, yeah, you look different than I thought. You look good, but you look different than I thought.
And let's face it, you guys. I mean, the reason we're all in radio is because we couldn't make it in TV anyway. Isn't that
three ugly guys sitting around here, folks. I'll tell you.
Are there radio groupies who call you up while you're on the air and try to set up rendezvous or whatever?
Well, I don't know about going quite that far with it, but there's definitely a clique of people, and lonely people, I think, who call radio stations, and we probably share a lot of the same callers at night, David and I. Just, you know, people who for some reason have nothing better to do than wish or think about that voice on the radio and want to kind of be near it, talking to it on the phone, so I don't know.
It doesn't usually go anywhere beyond talking on the phone, but a lot of people will call up every night and say, hi, how you doing, and they want to tell you what they're doing, and they want to find out what your life is like. And they, those people are sometimes disappointed when they find out you took the dog to the vets in the afternoon and, you know, you have a pretty normal life. You didn't go out with Mick Jagger or something, you know.
Well, I would imagine if you leave your phone lines open, as I guess you do in the studio, that it might be almost like running some kind of hotline, you know, that there might even be people calling up on the verge of committing suicide.
Sometimes you get a lot of seeking help. Really depressed people. And I sometimes feel a responsibility to stay on the phone with them and try to, you know, cheer them up or something, but you can't do that all the time.
Does that happen in the morning, or do you get a different type of phone call in the morning?
Mostly a different type. People are real busy in the morning. A lot of them are very surprised that I'll talk on the phone, and I try to answer the phones all the time, because if you don't answer them all, you've got to get into the old role of the FM disc jockey who lost the audience. Right. And if you're kind of thinking one way and you pick up the phone and everybody on the phone is going, hey, did you get the new Robert Palmer album yet? You start thinking, I better play that if everyone's calling for it.
Right.
It gets you good. A lot of times I find that girls, me high school seniors a lot, will call because all the guys they know are their age, and at that age they're all goons. So they say, well, hey, I talked to the disc jockey, and it's a male voice that's older that you know, they can fantasize that he just talked to Bruce Springsteen. You know, that's the image. You know, you're partying with Mick Jagger and, right. You know, talk to Bruce, and then you talk to them, and they really get surprised, which is, you know, the old radio star syndrome, which, you know, I think all of us here, most people in radio, most of the smarter ones anyway, just kind of treat it as, no, this is my job, and I just happen to have a job where I play records for you.
But
amazing, powerful thing about being on the media. I have worked in this town, and then I've not worked, and then I've worked again. Reactions to people when you're on, it's just powerful how you get disseminated. Your name gets disseminated, and people know you by your name. It's real powerful stuff, and I think that's what people react to, sort of as everybody knows.
Oh, yeah. You meet people who say, oh, yeah, you go out with my sister. Yeah, you sold drugs to my brother all the time. And you say, no, I don't even know your brother.
Right.
And they just, no, he said so. And people just, it's a good name to drop. They hear it every day on the air. They know everybody knows it. And they all make up stories about it.
That's true. I've heard lots of stories about myself that
really?
Didn't happen.
I've heard lots of stories about you, too.
I swear it wasn't me. There's also that deflating kind of phone call that you get, though, that just when you shut the microphone off after saying the most profound thing that you've had on the radio in 3 months, you've played a great record that nobody's heard, and you're sure that the phones are going to be ringing off the hook with people going, wow, that was great. You pick it up, and there's a little voice on the end that says, which one are you?
Right.
Oh, boy.
I wonder how seriously you take phone calls as being indicative of the larger audience, because sometimes I think that there's a certain kind of person who calls up. I mean, have you ever called a radio station?
That's funny. When I was younger, I did. Yeah, but
you did?
Not in a long time, you know, obviously. But my point lost me. Somebody else.
I called once a long time ago. I asked the guy for Grand Funk Railroad, and he told me to get lost.
Michael had a good point where you don't necessarily react to one phone call, but if four or five people call up and say, I want to hear whatever, you're going to say, and you're probably going to sneak that in. One phone call, though, can deflate you unbelievably. People do not understand, at least to me, if someone calls up and says, hey, you're a real jerk, you know, I'm going, oh, God, I'm going to have to examine what I'm doing and see if I am a jerk.
Do you all get lots of mail?
Aside
from contests, just general letters.
A handful of letters a week, I suppose.
Yeah.
How is that taken as an indication of anything? I guess the big indication is ratings, right? Is that the biggest indicator of how your show is working with an audience?
Maybe the biggest, not the best. There is no best.
We'll all argue against ratings, and you know, as someone once said, you live by ratings, you die by ratings. So if you are really puffed up when you got good ratings and they go down, you're going to be in trouble.
When you have the best ratings, you always believe in the rating system. When you have the worst, it's bad system.
Yeah. There's usually, frequently contests that the rock stations run, and sometimes it's like the 10th call or the first call. And I always imagine that like hundreds or thousands of people are calling up competing for what must be like 5 or 6 phone lines in the studio. What's happening at your end, David, when you've opened up the phones for one of these contests?
It's funny. A couple of things come out of that. Usually what happens is we've got 3 or 4 phone lines, and we do random number calls, and so I just tie them all up and open them up at a certain point, and that call comes through. We've had word from the phone company that we get outrageous amounts of phone calls into the exchange. Now, WISP is on the same exchange, and I think the two of us probably are really overburdening Bally Kinwood, you know. So that may have a lot to do with it, but it's pretty calm at our end. I mean, we just open up one phone line and take a call, and it happens pretty quickly.
Is it easy like that?
If we do something where we're picking a specific phone call, lots of times you'll pick a higher number because there are people that with those quick dial phones, and you want to make sure everybody gets a chance. So if you take call 20, we have 9 lines, and I would, as soon as I'm done talking and put a commercial on or the record, I'll go through them, and your call 1, you're a little bit early, sorry, try again. You get to say that so fast that you know they don't understand what you're saying. Try again. What? And we go through, and they'll ring for a real long time. It's an indication that there's a lot of people listening. Right. But as you said, it is a special type of person that does call a radio station. And probably it's indicative of the active audience rather than most of your audience, probably 99% of it, will never call, but they're just listening. And if you do something they don't like in the long run, they'll eventually just go to another radio station and you'll never ever hear from them anyway.
Mm-hmm. Tell me if you think this is true. It seems that, that now rock radio is basically a very white radio and that there's hardly any, if any at all, black groups that get played on radio stations. Where I remember, on white radio stations, that is, because there's white and there's black stations. Whereas I remember when I was growing up that on the stations with the white hosts, which I guess we could call a white station, there was a lot of black groups getting played, from like Stevie Wonder to the Temptations, Marvin Gaye, Smokey Robinson. The biggest groups were black groups.
Exactly. That is true. Radio is fragmentized
okay,
so much.
Well, what happened? How did that fragmentation happen?
I'll take care.
Go ahead.
Probably in the middle somewhere. As we spoke of before, maximizing your audience, getting the most audience, the people with the computers and the plans said, well, look, we're going after probably a 20-year-old guy, and he's the guy we want. And they started eliminating things. And they eliminated this, eliminated that. And they go, well, we got a black station in town. Let's not play black music. And they just kept eliminating things until they got this homogenized 20 songs or 20 groups, either one. And I think I see it now going back a little bit. I know at WMMR that it's very weird because we have the stuff in the studio. The albums are there, but nobody really goes for them. And I find myself, because I grew up on it, going, hey, a four top song would be real good. There are Temptations. And I'll throw it in, but there really isn't that much of it. Probably because of that homogenization. And everybody, I think, will start grabbing a little more and a little more.
It's funny. I think the contemporary black music you will not hear on any of these stations, except for maybe Stevie Wonder. But at the same time, you might hear older Motown things, which are stuff that our audience grew up with, more so than you would hear or old Sly. But I don't think you'd hear contemporary Lips Incorporated.
Radio always has a danger of assuming too much. They go, oh, no, our audience won't like this. When actually, you know, if you
play it. May not be true. I mean, you're right. You're
play
right.
It and, hey, that's okay. That sounds pretty good. You know, you'll be surprised when you talk to people at a bar in the street and you say, well, hey, remember the Four Tops? Yeah, yeah. How come I don't hear that? But they don't think about it because their life isn't radio as ours is. They don't get to sit around all day and listen to records. And so they're not reminded of it. And when you say, what about the Four Tops? It's the same as playing it. It's, oh, yeah, that'd be good. So I think that it, because of that homogenization of radio in some stations, in some areas, people just kind of forgot. And they don't call for it anymore. Once again, that cycle, that circle, they don't call for it because they don't hear it. If you played it a couple times, they might start calling, and then it might be big.
David, you mentioned Motown recordings. And, well, you both mentioned about how members of your audience grew up with that. I think it's interesting the way rock stations now have to take into account what their audience grew up with, because the audience, there's audience in their 20s and 30s who've already grown up.
That's funny.
And have a past.
I think that radio is coming around now to really taking into account, and I think it's kind of in a quandary trying to figure out what to do with the older rock listener. In fact, that's part of the fragmentation among these three stations here. WIOQ sees itself as aiming towards the upper end of that spectrum, your 25 to 34-year-old rather than your younger end of that. Now, one of the things they're going about doing that is softening the music and playing a lot more older stuff. I mean, time will tell as to whether this is the correct way to go about this, but one of the things we did vis-a-vis that was did a 60s flashback weekend, which turned out to be pretty successful. And one of the things, everybody sort of picked something that they wanted to do, and there was a psychedelic portion. And I sort of, one of the things I loved was old Top 40 radio, and I did a sock hop on a Friday night with playing old Tommy James and the Shondells and all this stuff. And it turned out to work, and people tended to really, for some reason, they were getting tired of hearing the same songs over and over now, same new songs, and they wanted to hear some of the things they heard when they were younger, and it's a whole flashback memory game, too. I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. But I was very interested, and I was a little bit surprised as to how popular it proved to be. Or I say popular by phone calls and mail. I don't know exactly what else.
Gary, your station, WYSP, you've pointed this out, and David mentioned that it's geared to a younger audience.
Right.
Do you feel different from your audience? Do you feel older than them, or that you grew up at a different time and that there's going to be some separation in your taste or experience?
Not a lot, really. I maybe I've never grown up, really. Some of my tastes in music were shaped in the 60s, and I, you know, on my turntable at home right now, Aretha Franklin and Otis Redding and people like that, but I like the music I play. I would find it real difficult to work if I didn't, and I've always liked a lot of high energy kind of music, which seems to be very popular with the younger audience, and I can relate to a good deal of the comments I get on the phone. You know, I have real empathy for them, so, yeah.
I think we all really remember how powerful radio was for us when we were younger, and I'm sure that's one of the reasons it makes it easier for you to do your job. If someone's on a Friday night, they're cruising around in their car, and they want to hear something real hot, you can definitely relate to that, and I think I could personally relate to hearing it, too, in the same situation.
Mm-hmm. So. It seems to be dying down a bit now, but the disco stations were doing enormously well recently, if not now. Do you think that they took listeners away from your stations, or were the disco stations drawing on a different group of people, do you think?
Well, we've been talking about age groups, really, younger, older, and stuff. Where it's funny, we don't really, at WMMR, we don't really think of it as an age group. It's kind of a, lack of a better term, psychographic group. I mean, the type of person that likes what we do doesn't necessarily, isn't younger, older, or whatever. It's just that type of person. There are lots of people I know that are in their 30s that just love AC/DC. And there are lots that we get calls all the time from somebody who's 13 years old and says, can I hear some Jimi Hendrix? Hendrix? How do you know about Hendrix? I don't know. But they just like it. So it's kind of a type of person rather than a particular age.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think that the disco stations drew away that type?
It was, I'm glad you brought that up because I forgot the question. disco stations, it was kind of a type of person. It wasn't necessarily older, younger. It was, hey, this stuff is good. And it wasn't black, white. What happened to it? I mean, there will always be dance music. It'll come back. What happened was, it seemed that a lot of rock stations got a little angry at disco, saying, ah, it's just disco.
Yeah, I remember there were some DJs who would go on these record-burning sprees.
Record smashing. Well, what it was, really, the public got behind it because it wasn't really the disco music. We now Miss You by the Rolling Stones, Straight On by Heart, Another One Bites the Dust by Queen. Those are disco songs. They happen to be done by rock groups. What happened was when somebody said, I had disco, people started thinking of disco not as a music form, but as a lifestyle. You know, nice clothes, you got to hang out, you can only afford one beer because you just bought some new jeans. And the lifestyle, a lot of the maybe working class, not necessarily working class, the average people, they couldn't afford this stuff. They're not going to go hang out in the disco every night. And they kind of rebelled against the lifestyle rather than the music form. And unfortunately, the music form suffered. Because people said, oh, that's disco. And rock radio stations went crazy. They went, uh-oh, better not play that because we'll get in trouble. And they just dropped everything that resembled a disco song when actually dance music has always been here.
Well, that's interesting what you mentioned about disco being associated with a lifestyle after a while and it being more than just a music. It was a way of life. Now, rock used to be, or maybe still is, associated with a specific lifestyle. People tend to identify themselves sometimes with the kind of music that they listen to and with the lifestyle that's attached to that music. Is there a lifestyle that you think goes along with the kind of music that you play?
Yeah, absolutely. The audience that I talk to is rediscovering a lot of the rebellious aspects of the 60s. And you meant, Michael mentioned Jimi Hendrix. With 13-year-old phone callers. It's true. The groups from the 60s that are resurfacing with the audience that YSP has, especially, I think, are the groups who were involved in the real core, you know, the doors, people who stepped out in front and were rebellious and did things that got them arrested, and Jimi Hendrix, you know, people who blatantly did drugs and played music that was louder or more, you know, powerful than the rest. Not mainstream groups, but the rebellious sort of groups. And they relate to that, I think.
I was just reading a survey somewhere in some store in Hartford, I think, where the Doors were the number 8 best-selling record in the store now. So, I mean, there's definitely...
We went for a long period, though, where the Doors had, you know, the popularity was nil. It got occasional play on our kind of radio stations, but this is a real resurgence in the last year or so, I think, with those groups.
David, is there a lifestyle, you think, associated with the music that you play?
It's hard to say. I'm probably the least prepared to say that because at least the way I have been told to envision my audience is a bunch of people who are going to work in the morning, coming home and relaxing with their kids, and it's an older audience. And I think they like rock and roll music, but I don't think they particularly have a rock and roll lifestyle. Why a YSB listener? I think it seems to me from listening to the station that you try to engender the whole raft race kind of thing is very much aimed towards a certain kind of a person.
More boisterous, outgoing,
a rocker.
Beer drinking, fun loving, radical, rebellious. Yeah.
Well, it's funny, we were talking about rock and roll, and if everybody will remember Bill Haley in the comments and Elvis Presley, that's rock and roll. So the term has been around for a long time, and if you consider that lifestyle, whatever lifestyle that may be, with the beer drinking lifestyle, I mean, it's totally different, and we're still talking about rock and roll. It's hard to envision the audience. It's very difficult because there's hundreds of thousands of people, and some of them are real little and going to school and haven't kissed anybody yet, and others are drinking beer every night with the boys, and others have 3 kids. It was a weird situation. I met a father, mother, and daughter that all listened to me and all liked the show. It was kind of weird because I was hitting them musically, and well, whatever I was doing on the air appealed to both of them. Not to say they all sat around and listened to me together. She listened with her friends, and her parents listened on the way to work, which is kind of weird about rock and roll, but that's how long it's been around. So it's hard to determine a lifestyle.
Yeah, you mentioned the thing of some listeners have never been kissed yet. Others are out drinking with the boys. I'm interested in that with the boy sensibility. I know that some people think that the biggest demographic for your record buying rock audience is male, and that therefore it's your utmost responsibility to program to those males because they'll go out and buy the records, and maybe in the long run, that's going to support you more. Do you think that rock radio is male-oriented in that regard? That's the sense of we, meaning us guys.
Not necessarily, but in our case, I think it leans more masculine, more male than female.
Why do you think that is, Gary?
Again, further fragmentation of the audience. It was we reached a point about maybe 18 months ago where IOQ and MMR and YSP could have traded frequencies and call letters, and you really wouldn't have been able to tell any difference among them. Everyone was playing a lot of Billy Joel and just lots of groups. It was difficult to tell the difference. And each of us, and the ones on either side of the table here, kind of took a step in a different direction. We toward the more raucous, and IOQ toward the more
softer,
yeah, laid-back style. And all in search of something that could be identified as our approach, you know, something that would make people know that they were listening to us when they turned the radio on, as opposed to, oh yeah, it's one of those stations. Because it's important to have an identity if you're trying to sell yourself. So.
And so for you, part of that identity has become that male orientation.
Drinking beer with the boys.
Right. I wonder how your female listeners are reacting to that.
Good question. No, I think that it maybe is too harsh to think of it in those terms. It's not a strictly male approach, but it just leans in that direction. I think that there are definitely a lot of female listeners. You can tell by the ratings.
In our instance, I think you draw the same conclusion as separating the age groups as you can males and females. We're dealing psychographically. There are girls that drink beer, and there are girls that love rock and roll. It's kind of a type of person. There are some females that would rather listen to Carly Simon, and there are just as many males that would rather listen to Carly Simon.
Oh, sure.
It's kind of you're just segmenting the people that like all the groups you play and the style of radio you do, whether it's male or female. I don't really think, we don't think of it as like, well, this is a good female record. We don't add records for that purpose. It's kind of, if they like our radio station, that's the type of person, the lifestyle, the psychographic that we're going for, not an age, not a gender.
Mm-hmm.
You get one of the things that I found, I don't know if I'm going to contradict this or not, but one of the things I found is in looking at research, radio seems to have a lot to do with research. There's a lot of companies that go out and ask questions of people in a certain age group, and they find that there are certain artists that appeal to women more than men. And at IOQ, we are trying to attract women listeners more than men. And I sometimes get a little rankled at that because by doing that, we're doing that by playing softer music and certain Billy Joel, James Taylor type artists. And I just, my gut feeling is that is selling the whole thing a little bit short, because I know a lot of women who like rock and roll too. And I sometimes wonder if perhaps, there has to be a little bit of that edge in there too. But the research seems to point out that there are certain artists that women are attracted to more.
Mm-hmm. So we've got two things working here. The attitude that the disc jockey expresses on the air towards women and the way music is programmed. I forgot what I wanted to ask you next. Oh yeah, now as three men sitting here, I wonder what you think. How accepted you think women are as disc jockeys? Many stations have a woman on the air. Many stations don't even have one woman on the air. If you look at it across the country, from your end, do you think that it's easy for a woman who's talented to be accepted by her peers at a station?
That's one of the problems with talented women, is that they go to radio, skip it, and go to television. I mean, I've found that a number of times, is that they won't stay in radio. If they're talented, they're going to be snapped up because they really are looking for talented women. Whenever I hear a good or bad disc jockey, I react basically as to whether I like them, as whether I think they're good, and I don't. There are women disc jockeys in this town I really like a lot, and there's some I don't think too much of. I think that it is you are very able, if you are at all, if you're given the opportunity, a woman is given the opportunity and she's good, she can do very, very well for herself, I think.
Mm-hmm. I tend to think the novelty is worn off of the idea of that it's a woman on the radio, right, as opposed to a man, at least in our form of radio.
Well, the novelty could have worn off, and that means that there's more women and they're more accepted, or that, well, we don't even need any women because the novelty is worn off, so what's the point?
Well, I think it's easier to be accepted.
Michael, what do you think?
I think the problem for a while was that when women decided to go into radio, or that they could, there was nobody to sound like. They had nobody to emulate.
That's
except for maybe Allison Steele in New York City, who had really kind of a sexist delivery, and there was nobody to sound like. And now as more women are on the air, there's more people to sound like, or to say, well, I don't have to sound like that screaming yo-yo. I can sound like me. And we were just filling a position, and I know that a lot of women applied, and we were regarding, not that the whole staff was in on the process, but the program director would have people listen, and I know we were choosing it as like, yeah, that's pretty good, that rather than, oh, it's a girl. It was really to find the best person, which is good. I think that's a major step, the best person, rather than, we need a girl because the FCC says we got to have a girl.
Right. There was a real problem with women only being able to sound a certain way, only being able to be the sexy broad. But now I find that women sound all kinds of different styles, which is neat.
Well, we're about out of time. I wonder what you listen to at home before we close this conversation. We know what you play on the radio. At home, you can choose from anything. What are you apt to listen to at home?
Right now, I'm listening to a lot of what one is going to have to call new wave music. I'm listening to short little pop songs, which are things I've always loved, and there's a lot of real good stuff out now. Some of it I'm not playing.
Well, it's hard.
Yeah, I listen to jazz.
We listen to what we do for our jobs, most people do for their leisure. So lots of times I'll turn on the TV and get real mad. I'll listen to all the radio stations I can. I would drive me crazy if I had to follow me, because I just keep turning the dial and changing, putting records on, jazz, changing styles, classical. I'll listen to anything as long as it's not exactly what I do all day.
Gary?
Old-time rock and roll, rhythm and blues, country and western in the morning.
I wish I thought of this sooner and left more time for it, but what effect is, how much room is there on your station for new kinds of music that may or may not have a large commercial following initially, like New Wave?
IOQ is, at this point, trying pretty hard to stay with stuff that's tried and true, so I don't think there's that much.
Michael, MMR?
No, we're experimenting in a lot of areas. We have a special show that deals with a lot of New Wave, and we have a jazz show and an oldies show, and as far as the regular programming is concerned, we'll try new things.
In featured slots, like Michael says, we'll try new things also, but tried and true is the rule, playing it safe.
Okay, well, we're out of time. I want to thank all of you for coming and talking with us this afternoon. We've been talking about rock radio in Philadelphia. With me has been Gary Bridges, who is just speaking from WYSP. He's on in the evenings from 6 to 10. Michael Picozzi, who spoke before him, is the morning man on WMMR. He's on from 6 to 10 in the morning. Also with us has been David Dye of WIOQ, and he's on from 6 until 10 in the evenings. And David's is a voice you might have heard before here on WUHY. Thanks to all of you for being here this afternoon on Fresh Air.